Welcome to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. This show will first be broadcast on Wednesday, October 29, 2025, on 91.7 FM WHUS Doors. I am Fran Storch, ND, naturopathic physician. My co-host Ron Meniza is preparing for the elections. Very exciting. We're coming to you live from beautiful Mansfield Hollow, Connecticut. Comment below to let us know you're here and ask questions. You can also email me at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, and Buzzsprout. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch ND for 30 days and also on my YouTube channel at Radio Naturopath. The views expressed on this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. So, post-surgically, I recorded recently, and since I have recorded, my knee is a little bit better. I've been walking around on it and the pain is a little bit less in that medial side. Let's hope it gets better over time. And Ron asked me, what do you think did it? I said, I don't know. Part of it is just time. If it is all the things I do, it's probably the supplements that I take, the anti-inflammatories, the fish oil, black cumin seed oil, evening primrose oil, collagen, curcumin. And as I said, I'm interested in taking glucosamine, which I may start as soon as tomorrow. I just have to get some. And so I'm trying these different things. And, you know, I haven't been doing a lot of icing. I didn't walk as much this weekend, although I did do some walking this weekend. I haven't done my PT exercises since Thursday, so I need to get back on that. And I'll probably do that today after I make my show. Anyway, so thank goodness it's getting better. I'm looking forward to November 12th when I will go see a doctor directly about my knee and get some more clarity there. Maybe they'll order an MRI. We'll see what happens. Here's to hoping for everybody that they do extend the tax breaks for people who are on the Affordable Care Act so that most people's insurance doesn't, the people who are on the Affordable Care Act are looking at a possibility of their insurance premiums skyrocketing. And I got my notice from the Affordable Care Act that here's the plans that are available. The plan I had last year is still available. A lot of it's the same, but I noticed that where there wasn't a copay on medications, now there is one. So we might be getting a bit less for more money. I don't know. I don't know what the subsidies will be like. I'm hoping that they don't cancel the subsidies so that we're talking about 24 million Americans. And I don't know if the government thinks, well, because there's 333 million people in America, 24 million isn't that many people. The funny thing is that 75% of the people on the Affordable Care Act are in states that carried the Republicans in the last election. It's going to be very unpopular if they don't continue those subsidies. So I don't know what they're going to do. The government is still shut down, and they're shut down because Democratic representation doesn't want to agree to a bill that doesn't extend those subsidies. So let's hope that they do. And if they don't, let's hope that whatever your situation is, that you continue to have health insurance so that you can get medical care covered for whatever it is you need. I'm hoping for that for myself as well. Let's hang in there. Ron's still out and about. His neck is still healing. He's had some setbacks where he's had some cramping. He's not sure if something is offset. So he'll probably talk to the doctor about that and see what's going on there. All right. So this week, if you're listening, you're probably listening to this at least on October 29th. So we wanted to talk about Halloween and the Day of the Dead. As you can see, I'm wearing a Sugar Skull t-shirt in honor of the Day of the Dead. And the Day of the Dead is a tradition that's mostly happens in Mexico. And of course, there's a lot of traditions that celebrate Halloween, Day of the Dead. There's alternative celebrations of it. There's Christian celebrations of the Day of the Dead. They call it All Saints Day in November 1st. And then Halloween it's Halloween because it's the hallowed evening before All Saints Day. And that's why it's called that. It's not because, you know, it's not technically supposed to be a day where you celebrate ghosts and goblins and things. And it's become very commercialized. But I think it comes from the Day of the Dead, the idea that you're celebrating people who have passed. And in Mexico, they have this beautiful ceremony where they have an ofrenda. An ofrenda is a Spanish word that means an offering. And it's a table that has decorations and treats and photos of the departed. And you celebrate the people who have left you. And in Judaism, we have ways of celebrating that too. And, for example, on this past Thursday, I went to my friend's house where she had what we call a minyan. A minyan is a congregation of 10 adult, past the age of bar mitzvah, Jews. And when you have that many, you can have a service. And so there were way more than 10 people in her house. I'm not even sure how many. There could have been 50. It was a lot of people. And it was wonderful because it was a great celebration of the father of my friends who had just passed. And God bless him, Baruch Dayan HaEmet, which means God is the true judge. It's a traditional thing you say in Judaism when someone passes. He lived to 98 years, and she had such loving, wonderful things to say about this guy. And so God bless her that she had such a wonderful experience with her father right up till the very end. And he saw beauty in all things all the time, right up to the end of his life. It was just such a lovely thing to hear about. So anyway, so the Day of the Dead is coming up. It will be Saturday coming as you're listening to this. And of course, Halloween is the day before that. And there's all kinds of cute celebrations. I wonder if the celebration of sugar, because, you give sugary treats on Halloween. I'm not sure if that's just a commercial thing or if it does come from the Day of the Dead. Because what do they do on the Day of the Dead? They celebrate with sugar skulls. So I was wondering about sugar skulls, because here I'm wearing a sugar skull. I hope that's not considered appropriation. I'm not sure anybody's too concerned about that. But sugar skulls in Spanish are called calaveras. And calavera is just a word that means skull. That's the word for skull. Cabeza is head. Cabello is hair. And cerebro is your brain. But calavera is your skull, the bony part. So in the context of Day of the Dead, is a representation of the skull or skeleton, and it's often applied to edible, or I didn't know that sugar skulls could also be made to be eaten, that you can get sugar skull candy. But I just thought they were decorations and they could be made from anything. But they're called sugar skulls because the traditional thing is to make them out of sugar. Who knew? So it's they're usually made from either sugar, and when they're and the sugar paste that they make sugar skulls out of is called alfeñiques. Also can be made of clay, and they're used in the Mexican celebration of Day of the Dead and the Roman Catholic holiday All Souls Day, or All Saints Day, whatever. Some people call it All Souls Day, some people call it All Saints Day, and that's the first, November 1st. I think they may celebrate it on the 2nd as well. So this weekend, it'll be the 1st and the 2nd. So it's a whole weekend that you can celebrate the Day of the Dead. So calavera can also refer to any artistic representation of skulls or skeletons. There's an artist, Jose Guadalupe Posada, who did a lot of skull representations. And you can give gifts or treats in relation to the Day of the Dead. So a lot of calaveras are created with cane sugar, decorated with items like colored foil, icing, beads, and sometimes objects such as feathers. So if they have non-edible things on them, you probably don't want to eat them. But you can get sugar skulls that are specifically to be eaten, and they're just decorated with, they're made of sugar, and they're decorated with icing, a sugar and probably some flour. They make a paste, and they're able to make it into a skull. And then they put icing on it in all different colors, and it's pretty. They weren't traditionally used on loved ones' ofrendas, although they are now. In Mexico, children who have died are celebrated on the 1st of November, and adults are thought to return on November 2nd. I did not know this. The departed tend to return home to enjoy the offerings on the altar. Some believe they consume the essence of the food offerings. Others believe they merely sense or savor them without consuming them. Interesting. In pre-Columbian times, that's before Christopher Columbus came to the New World, caricaturists like Manuel Mania and Jose Guadalupe Posada made influential calaveras, who were accompanied by satirical rhymed commentaries. And the most famous one is Posada's Katrina, which I'd never heard of, who wears a big feathered hat. She was elaborated by Diego Rivera into a full figure with a long dress, and that figure has been reworked by many other artists. Katrina is the most famous figure associated with Day of the Dead. All things I did not know. During the Day of the Dead, skulls and skeletons are created from many materials like wood, sugar paste, nuts, chocolate. When sugar skulls are purchased or given as gift, the name of the deceased is often written with icing across the forehead of the skull and colored foil. Very nice. So it's like, I didn't know that you could get chocolate sugar skulls. I may have to look for that. So they're produced with molds to cast the calaveras, and the production is more focused on the aesthetic appeal than the taste or the food safety. So you have to be careful when you eat it, depending on what it's decorated with. And it's decorated with non-food items, you shouldn't eat them. Calaveras are traditionally sold at outdoor market stalls, beginning days or a couple weeks before the Day of the Dead in Mexico. And the most famous place to purchase sugar skulls and related confections could be made of chocolate, marzipan, candied vegetables, is in the Alfeñique Fair in Toluca, which is near Mexico City. Now you know. Some calaveras are produced to be edible. Some are cast as one piece from cane sugar, which can either be unflavored or flavored with vanilla. Some calaveras are also made from chocolate. The calaveras, I'm going to look for chocolate calaveras. That sounds exciting. They're typically colored with vegetable dyes, as with the more decorative calaveras. These are sometimes have names written on foreheads. So you can get clay skulls, and then there's poetry for the Day of the Dead, known as literary calaveras. This is all stuff I didn't know. And then there's face painting, the act of painting a human face to resemble a skull, sometimes known as face painting. Sugar skull makeup, Katrina or Calaca face paint, is not a traditional practice during Day of the Dead, except for Katrina impersonators. However, it's become popular in recent years in urban centers. And where I'm looking, there's all kinds of pictures of people with face paint from sugar skulls. So who knows? So that's the deal with sugar skulls. Sugar skulls can be made from sugar. They aren't necessarily made from sugar. And if they have anything on them that isn't edible, you shouldn't eat them. And if you buy a sugar skull and you want to eat it, just make sure that it's safe to eat, because they're not necessarily concerned about, like they could be made from sugar paste and then have paint on them or some other kind of decoration that's not really edible. So be careful of that. That if you go and find some sugar skulls online, I have never seen edible sugar skulls in a store, but then maybe if I want to see that, I need to go to a bodega. And we have bodegas owned by Mexican people in Willimantic. So maybe I should go check. And I'll see. And I'm sure you can find edible sugar skulls online. I'm excited about the chocolate ones because I'm generally excited about chocolate. So since we're talking about candy on Halloween, let's talk about candy and health. So candy can be a big problem if you have tooth issues. It definitely can cause tooth decay. If you eat candy, it's really a good idea, as my dentist tells me. Make sure you drink water while you're drinking while you eat the candy. And when you're done with the candy, you should at least drink water to wash the sugar out of your mouth. One thing that's really not a good thing to do is have at the last thing you do before you go to sleep at night to eat some kind of sweet and then not brush your teeth. So the best thing you can do is if you have dessert at night, You have to decide, dessert or anything sweet at all, or even any food at all, you have to decide on a cutoff time for all eating for the night, not drinking water. You can drink all the plain water that you like, but in terms of sugar on your teeth, it's not a good idea to have sugar on your teeth overnight. So please try to brush your teeth before you go to bed, says mom, right? But it's a really good idea to brush your teeth before you go to bed. And if you can, floss. If you want to do to pick your teeth with a rubber tip, you can do that. That helps with your gum health. And if you want to also water floss, you can do that. I tend to rinse with an antimicrobial rinse that has tea tree oil in it. And then the best thing you can do is apply a paste that has either fluoride or calcium hydroxyapatite in it and leave that on your teeth overnight. And you want to avoid having any water for half an hour after you apply the paste. And then after you've applied the paste and after half an hour goes by, then drink water. You can drink water all night. When drinking water is helpful for your oral health because it helps to get rid of any plaque and bacteria that are sitting in your mouth. That can cause decay. But if you eat sweets and then they sit on your teeth overnight, that's going to lead to more decay. And it's a great thing to clean as much of the sugar out of your mouth and then put on an enamel enhancer. So you've heard me talk before about the use of fluoride is controversial because there's a concern that if you use fluoride can replace other minerals in your body that can get into your bones. It can possibly replace iodine in thyroid hormone. There's concerns about that. My thought is if you're using a little bit of fluoride topically, not if you're ingesting it, but if you're putting a little bit of fluoride on top of your teeth, it's probably not going to do too much. Fluoride and calcium hydroxyapatite, when you place fluoride on your teeth, it creates fluoroapatite on your teeth. And fluoride definitely does block cavities from getting in. It blocks the lacunae, the little lakes, the little tiny spots in your teeth that make your teeth a little bit porous, and it blocks them so bacteria can't get in. And so if you put that on your teeth overnight, bacteria is less likely to get in and cause decay. So when you put fluoride on you, so you can get fluoride pastes, and the one I like has fluoride, and as long as you're not dairy intolerant, MCC or MPP paste. It's got a paste in it that has calcium phosphate. It's got a phosphate in it, and then it has the fluoride in it. And that can create both calcium hydroxyapatite and fluoroapatite on the surface of your teeth and help to prevent cavities. You can also get products that have calcium hydroxyapatite in them. So either one, if you put it on your teeth, the last thing, then you resolve not to eat anything else for the rest of the night. And when you put it on, wait half an hour before consuming water. And then if you have a lot of problem with decay, I would put it on twice a day, put on either the fluoroapatite, the fluoride paste with the MCP in it or MPP in it. And also put it on at night, and so that you have coverage for both parts. You'll have coverage for a little while in the morning. The thing is, you tend to eat throughout the day, so you lose some of that, but it's going to be more effective if you leave it on before you go to bed. So make sure you do that. So let's talk about healthier candy for Halloween. So of course, eating fruit is going to be healthier than eating anything with refined sugar in it. So making fruity treats for Halloween can be a good idea. You can take little apples and carve them out and decorate them that way. And you can just eat apples if you want to. And this is definitely the apple and pear time of year. The apples and pears are great right now. And depending on the orchard that you get your stuff from, they may have great ways of storing their apples so that they stay fresh or tasty and don't get mealy over the course of the winter, after the growing season is done. So having fruit as snacks is a great thing. And then so then there are different kinds of candies that people like to eat. So one of my favorite things, unfortunately, is fruit snacks, those chewy little fruit snacks. And different brands have different issues. So you can get fruit snacks from the regular store. They will have natural and artificial flavors in them, but sometimes they have artificial colors. And it's not a great thing, especially to give to children. You don't want to be giving children artificial colors. Artificial colors often cause emotional issues. They can increase ADHD. They can increase cognitive issues. And they can, I had a patient not too long ago that they gave their child artificial coloring, and the child had nightmares after that. And when they stopped the artificial coloring, the child's nightmares stopped. So it definitely can affect your brain. So staying away from artificially colored stuff, especially for children, is important. So if you're eating fruit snacks, look at the fruit snacks, look at the ingredients on the package, and make sure they don't have artificial dyes. It'll say things like red 40, yellow 5, blue number. I'm not sure if it's blue number 4, but anyway, it'll have different markings that way. You can get fruit snacks. Now, we found fruit snacks at one store that were organic and all natural, and all the flavorings and colorings were absolutely natural. They were colored with things like annatto and beet juice and berry juice, which is great, and all the flavorings were natural. The only thing is it had wheat starch in it, so it wasn't gluten-free. The one common fruit snack that you can get anywhere is gluten-free, so it has no wheat starch in it. It may have tapioca starch in it, but But it sometimes, it definitely has artificial, some artificial flavors, is natural and artificial flavors, and you have to check it to make sure there's no artificial color in it. There is a brand that's completely clean. It's gluten-free, and it's flavored with only natural fruit juice, natural flavoring, and is colored only with vegetable and fruit juices. So when you're eating your chewy little fruit snacks, make sure that it's really best. If you're not gluten intolerant, you can get the one with the wheat starch in it. If you are gluten intolerant, you want to avoid that. Now, when I was studying celiac disease years ago, I had a professor who was talking to us about celiac disease at a conference, and she said that in Britain, they consider wheat starch to be gluten-free, and they use wheat dextrin in products, and they consider it to be gluten-free. I wouldn't try it. I would never give Ron, Ron, who is severely gluten intolerant. Again, we don't know if he has celiac disease, because when we took him off gluten, he didn't have health insurance, so we didn't do the antibody testing. So we don't know if he has celiac or if he's just got a non-celiac gluten sensitivity. But I wouldn't give him wheat starch. So I'm very disappointed that this brand I found that's organic, and it's organic, it has natural flavoring, has natural coloring, and it's got wheat starch in it. So there is another brand you can get that's completely clean, and you can find that at a variety of stores. I've even seen it at Staples. So when you go to Staples, when you go to the checkout, it's like a lot of places. You go to the checkout, and the store isn't particularly a food store, and they have all kinds of, you have to go through a little maze before you get to the checkout, and they put all kinds of impulse buys there. And Staples sells food treats, and one of the food treats that they sell are fruit snacks, several brands of them, and one of them is the all-natural brand, and one of them is the common brand that you see everywhere. Yeah, the other place that they sell all kinds of food, as you have to go through a long maze before you get to the checkout, is TJ Maxx. TJ Maxx and Marshall's both do this, and if you live in a state where they have Ross Dress for Less, they don't have Ross Dress for Less. I don't think they have Ross Dress. They definitely don't have it in Connecticut, and they don't have it in Massachusetts. I don't know if that's because the TJX Corporation has such a hold on Connecticut and Massachusetts, because TJX Corporation is based in Natick, Mass. And so if you're in Connecticut, you've got lots of TJ Maxx and you've got lots of Marshalls. And then you go through this maze before you get to the checkout, and they have all kinds of snacks. And it didn't used to be that way at Kohl's. And now if you go to Kohl's, same thing. There's a maze that you go through with, and half the stuff that they have in that maze is impulse buy treats. And sometimes they're good treats too. And sometimes they're kind of holistically oriented. And the other thing they'll tend to have is HABA stuff, health and beauty aids. So they'll be little inexpensive health and beauty aids and HABA stuff. And sometimes it's little electronic accessories like headphones and things like that. And so you have to be careful. But sometimes you get good deals there and you get things that are healthy and gluten-free. And it's interesting to see what they have. So anyway, as I said, if you're going to eat those chewy fruit snacks and honey upset dental hygienists and dentists because they stick to your teeth. And my hygienist was like, stay the heck away from them. And my dentist was more like, drink water. After you take it, drink water. And my thing is, it's a good idea to do the hydroxyapatite or fluoride paste with the calcium phosphate in it before bed, and don't drink anything, don't consume anything for half an hour, and then you can have water the rest of the, keep water on your nightstand. I think that's a good idea. Some people restrict their water a bit because they're afraid they're gonna have to get up and go to the bathroom. I don't worry about it. I have water on my nightstand because I have a little bit of dysautonomia left over from when I was injured by the vaccine. And so I have to make sure I'm hydrated. And my autonomic nervous system is a little unhappy right now because I'm dealing with, healing from knee stuff and back stuff and leg stuff. So my autonomic nervous system is a little angry at me for being injured. And so so I kind of have to keep hydrated, which is why you'll see me grabbing water. I always have water next to me. I have water on the desk right now. In fact, I'll have some right now. Yay. It's good for me to drink water while I'm on the air because it keeps me moisturized and hydrated. It's good. So there's that. All right. And so chocolate. So chocolate is everybody's favorite. Or it, actually, that's not true. Not 100% of people like chocolate, but people who love chocolate really love chocolate. Wonder if you could hear the blue jay singing in the background. Because I like to keep the window open in here, even though this is a small, close room. So it's good for recording because you don't want there to be extra noise. And yet it gets stuffy in here, so I have to open the window. And when you open the window, we have a bird feeder, so the birds, you hear the birds. Oh, and by the way, very interesting. Yesterday I was lying in bed and I saw a great big black bird with very large wings swoop down and then alight on the shed in the back. At first I couldn't, before the bird alit and sat, I wasn't quite sure what it was because it was a great big bird, had a very large wingspan, and I couldn't tell if it had a black head or a white head, and Ron suggested that it might have been an eagle because we do have bald eagles around here. But then the bird sat down on the shed and it was by itself, and it was a large black bird. It was 100% black. It had a somewhat curved beak and it was by itself. And so that was a raven. So I saw a raven. So when you see a raven, it's about transition, and some people think it's about death. I think it's, I would like to believe that it is not about, not, that I am not about to die, but that I am going through transition because I'm going through a lot of healing. You know, my orthopedics need to heal and transform and change so I can go into the next phase of my life. That, you know, I really had to aggressively address my back and my knee. So I think that's what the, that's what I would like to believe the raven was about. It was, and I was very excited to see the raven because I'm not sure I've seen a raven before that where I was really like, I could tell that it was a raven and not a crow. The deal with ravens is ravens tend to hang out by themselves or in pairs, and crows, you know what a group of crows is called. A group of crows is called a murder. And crows are, they're both very smart. Ravens and crows are very intelligent. And crows tend to be very social. That when you see a crow, you'll see a group of them. They hang out in murders and they chat with each other and they communicate. Whereas ravens, you'll see, when you see them, they're by themselves or they're, might be with another raven. This raven was alone. And it was enormous. The wingspan was very impressive. And crows flap their wings more, whereas ravens will do more of, they look more like a raptor the way that they fly because they'll swoop and circle and do more acrobatic stuff. And this one definitely swooped down low, and it looked like the way that a hawk would fly. And we definitely have hawks around. We have red-tailed hawks and different kinds of hawks in the area. You know, because we live in Mansfield Hollow and we have woods, and so we have a lot of animals that we get to see. We get to see deer and skunks and raccoons and possums and the occasional fisher and bunnies. The bunnies come to our yards as well. And what one thing I have not seen, now my friend Randy, who lives in South Windsor, gets bears in her yard, and I've never seen a bear in Mansfield. And we supposedly have bears in Mansfield Hollow, but I guess there's enough space for them and enough food for them that they don't need to come to into your yard. I'm not sure if people have seen bears in Mansfield Hollow. They must have, because I'm pretty sure that they're there, but I've never seen one in my yard. And so, I think they are, if they're here, they have enough to do in the woods without coming around here. And, you know, we keep our trash locked up so that they can't get to it. So it's not exciting for them to come here. So I don't know, maybe there are other places in town where the houses are closer together that they do see bears. I'm not sure. So I have to ask Ron about that. Anyway, so we were going to talk about chocolate. So chocolate, there is a little bit of a concern that chocolate could have lead in it, depending on the kind of chocolate that you eat. And then there's the issue of the different kinds of chocolate. And you know that there's chocolate with milk in it. There's white chocolate. White chocolate doesn't have flavonoids in it, but it does have the healthy stearic acid in it, which is saturated fat that's actually good for your health and can lower cholesterol. And all chocolate has that to an extent. The lower the cocoa content of chocolate, of course, you're going to get less antioxidants and flavonoids. There is concern that some chocolate could have, you know, things, depending on what the animals are eating, when there's milk in it, there could be some heavy metal concern with chocolate. So also with chocolate, you have to be careful. Chocolate is not as much of a concern in terms of oral health, but again, you know, when you eat sugar, when you have something with sugar in it, you need to be drinking water afterwards. And then, like I said, end of the day, brush your teeth, rinse your mouth out, make sure, put on some of the either hydroxyapatite or calcium hydroxyapatite or the CPP with the MI paste with fluoride in it, and leave it on overnight, and you'll have less damaging effects from sugar. Of course, not eating sugar at all is the best way to go for that, but not everybody's going to do that. When you eat chocolate, you're going to get the most antioxidant benefit the higher the cacao content. And the issue with chocolate is not the chocolate. The issue with chocolate is sugar. If your chocolate has no sugar in it, it's not going to rot your teeth. So that's something to think about. That if you have a salad, like a fruit salad, and you put cacao nibs in it, the cocoa, you'll taste that cocoa flavor and you'll get the sweetness from the fruit and you don't get the sugar and you don't get the damage to your teeth. Although there's a little bit of a concern with fruit because fruit has organic acids in it. So again, after you eat fruit, it's a good idea to drink water. All right. So that's Halloween. Enjoy your Halloween. Enjoy your All Saints Day. Enjoy your Day of the Dead. However you celebrate, have fun, be mindful. If you celebrate in such a way where you have a belief that the veil is the thinnest between here and the heavens and you can communicate with your departed relatives, you can celebrate that way. In Judaism, we don't do that. I mean, if you want to and you're Jewish, you could do that if you want to. But there are some Jews who believe you don't celebrate other people's holidays. But what we do is we say Kaddish. So that's a specific prayer. That Kaddish is used at different points in the service. It's not always the mourner's Kaddish, but there is a special mourner's Kaddish. A lot of the words are the same as for the other Kaddishes. And when we went to Randy's house, we said Kaddish. We helped Randy say we said Kaddish with Randy for her departed father. And for 11 months after the passing of a first degree relative is a father or mother, you know, a parent or a child or a sibling. And for nearly a year after that, you stand up and say the full Kaddish at any service that you go to and anytime you have a chance. And then a week after the passing of the loved one, Judaism traditionally is supposed to bury a loved one within 24 hours of their passing, because we don't do anything to the body. We're not supposed to, you're supposed to go out the way you came in. You're really not supposed to get piercings or tattoos. And you're certainly not supposed to embalm. Judaism traditionally doesn't do cremation, which is not to say that some Jews don't choose to treat cremation. They do. But traditionally, that's not what's done. You get buried in a simple shroud, in a plain wooden box, a plain wooden casket that's not particularly adorned, and that's how you go in. And so you're supposed to be buried within 24 hours of passing, unless it's the Sabbath, and then you wait till the next day after the Sabbath. It doesn't usually happen because we don't live in communities with all of our families. So if you want your family to come for the memorial, you probably have to wait a couple of days. So like if your loved one passes on a Wednesday, you're probably going to have the funeral on Sunday and you're going to wait for everybody to get into town to do it. That's how that usually goes. And traditionally, I mean, if you're very traditional, if you're Orthodox, that's not what's going to happen. The person's going to get buried within 24 hours. But if you're not that traditional, then the body has to wait a few days. And then there's a group called the Chevra Kadisha, and the Chevra Kadisha is a group that prepares the body for burial. And it's a group that is usually part of the synagogue or part of the local community. And they it's not their loved one that passed, and their job is to prepare the body. Probably there's ritual washing, and then there's putting them in the shroud, putting them in the casket, and then people sit with the body until it's buried, and people take turns sitting with the body until it's time for the burial. And so that the family themselves who are mourning, they don't have to take care of that. The Chevra Kedisha does all that. So we had Chevra Kedisha for my father when he passed, and things are set up for when my mom's time comes, which isn't going to be for 20 years. I don't know. So God bless my mother. That may she live for many, many more years and in good health. And so I can go back and visit her once my orthopedics get better. Anyway, so that's what we do in Judaism. And in Judaism, we also light a candle. It's called, so the anniversary of a death is called their Yahrzeit. And you light a candle on the anniversary of their death. And you do the anniversary, you light on the anniversary of the death in the Hebrew calendar. So the Gregorian date changes every year. So you have to know what the date is. My father passed 2 days after my Hebrew birthday. I was born on the 12th of Kislev, which happened to be November 28th in 1963. And my father passed in 2016 on the 14th of Kislev. So 2 days after my Hebrew birthday is my father's Yahrzeit. So I light a candle at night, in the evening, because the Jewish days, they start at sundown. So I light it at around sundown, and I let it burn till it's burned out. And then there are several times a year where you say Yizkor, which is a prayer where you remember your departed ones. And you say Yizkor every year. Once you have a first-degree relative that has passed, you say Yizkor every year for that departed relative. So I didn't mention a spouse. So it's a parent, a child, a sibling, or a spouse. You also say Yizkor and Kaddish for your spouse. So anyway, so my mother says Yizkor for my father and lights a candle. So there are other times of the year that you light the Yahrzeit candle, and that is what we call Shemini Atzeret on during Sukkot. So, and you light it on Yom Kippur. So on Erev Yom Kippur, you light a Yahrzeit candle because you say Yizkor in Yom Kippur. And then there's another Yizkor at the end of Sukkot, which is about a week later, or roughly a week later. And so it's like you're lighting two Yahrzeit candles in quick succession. Then the next one for me would be the Yahrzeit, the actual Yahrzeit, the passing of my father. And then after that, you light a candle at the end of Passover, and you light a candle at the end of Shavuot. So there's four holidays a year where you light Yahrzeit candles. That's Yom Kippur, Sukkot, Shavuot, and Passover. And then you light it at the Yahrzeit. So you need five candles a year for a person. And, you know, I don't know if you wind up lighting a candle for every relative. My mother suggested you just light one for everybody because poor mom, she would have to light for her mother, her father, my father, and just Uncle Arnold. Yeah, and her, one of her siblings, Uncle Arnold. Uncle Michael and Aunt Jane are still with us. Thank God. Okay, so that's how you do it. So that's the Jewish way of remembering stuff, in case you didn't know. All right, so let's get on to some actual health stuff. And let's start with help for menorrhagia. So menorrhagia is something that a lot of women suffer with. Menorrhagia is a word that means menses with a lot of bleeding. All right, that's what it means. So when you have rhagia, any kind of rhagia is a lot of, that's a word that means a lot of bleeding. So a hemorrhage is when you have a lot of bleeding. So menorrhagia is like, so a menorrhage, which would be a hemorrhage of your menses. So menorrhagia is the noun for that. So there's a lot of ways you can help to stop heavy periods. But I have so many, it's amazing how many patients I have with heavy periods. And I was very blessed in that I didn't have that growing. Like I had maybe a day that was heavy, but I never had such heavy periods that I became iron deficient. But I see that with alarming frequency. I have lots of women who come in, they have heavy periods, they have a lot of cramping, they may get diagnosed with polycystic ovaries, they may get diagnosed with adenomyosis or endometriosis, and some people just have what we call dysfunctional uterine bleeding, where they just bleed a lot. And so it is, it's not uncommon. If, pardon me, if your period is so heavy that you quickly soak through pads or tampons, or have to double up on different kinds of protection, there's things you can do for relief. Of course, you should talk to a doctor. Whether you talk to a naturopath, probably a good idea to pull out all the stops. Talk to your naturopath, your chiropractor. Why a chiropractor? Because if your chiropractor can adjust you, and if they can help you to have better pelvic blood flow, then it can help your menses to be more normal. So acupuncturist definitely can help you help with your liver function and help to make your blood less thin with different acupuncture points and help you hormonally. So that's something that can help. And you certainly want to consult with a gynecologist who can help you in various ways, whether hormonal, and depending on how serious it is, there are a lot of treatments. If you bleed so much that you have trouble breathing, or you pass clots the size of a quarter or larger, or feel faint or lose consciousness, you need to go to the ER. So if that's not what's going on, then here's some other things you can do. If you're losing a lot of blood, you need to drink water. So drink extra cups of water when you bleed heavily. And the number is about 4 to extra cups. And you can also have a little bit of extra salt for more electrolytes. Because if you're drinking extra water, you have to balance that with drinking more electrolytes. So you can have a little bit of extra salt in your meals, or you can drink electrolyte drink. Eat foods that are high in iron. Your body, when you bleed, you're losing iron because there's hemoglobin in the blood that you're losing, and the hemoglobin carries iron, and iron's job is to carry oxygen to all of the cells of your body. So foods that are high in iron, legumes like lentils, chickpeas, soybeans, peas, liver and other organ meats, spinach, shellfish like clams, oysters, and mussels, ground beef or other red meats, quinoa, pumpkin seeds, turkey, broccoli, and tofu. Another way to get more iron on board is to cook in cast iron, a skillet or a pot or a pan, and you'll get some iron leaching into your food, which is helpful. You shouldn't do that if you're not iron deficient, and if you have hemochromatosis, which is where you tend to store excess iron, you shouldn't do that. But it's a good thing to do if you're iron deficient. Make sure you're taking in enough vitamin C, because vitamin C does a couple of things. It can help to reduce bleeding because it helps to strengthen vitamin C and bioflavonoids. They help with the integrity of blood vessels, so it can help to reduce bleeding, and also helps you to absorb iron. It's a cofactor for iron absorption. So here's some vitamin C high foods aside from citrus. Citrus is high in vitamin C, so please have at the citrus if you tolerate it well. But here's some cool stuff that's not citrus that's high in vitamin C. Guavas, green chili peppers, rose hips, acerola cherries, kakadu plums. I don't know what those are. I bet they're sour. Guava, yellow bell peppers, black currant. So it's interesting because, you know, citrus doesn't grow in Great Britain. And, you know, being vitamin D deficient can be an issue in Great Britain. And so black currants are high in vitamin C. And so we're not as excited about black currants in the United States. You rarely see people using currants for stuff, although I did get some sourdough at Flower Girl that had black currants in it, and it was yummy. And I like to get black currants sometimes and use them instead of raisins. Black currants as well as goji berries. There's a great alternatives to raisins. They're a little bit lower in sugar, and they have a lot of antioxidants in them, including vitamin C. So when you go to Britain, there's a breakfast beverage called Ribena, and Ribena is it's black currant juice, and because black currants, the genus of black currant is Ribes. Ribes nigrum is black currant, and so Ribena is black currant juice. So I don't know if you can get black currant juice. I think I've seen Ribena in the States, but I remember learning about it when I used to travel to Britain. And so black currants are a source. You can get dried black currants at the Woolly Co-op, and sometimes you'll see fresh ones. But black currants, you can find them. Definitely the Woolly Co-op has them, and you might find them in other stores. You can certainly get them online. Parsley, fresh parsley has a lot of vitamin C. Mustard, spinach. So I guess that's a variety of spinach that's a little spicier than regular spinach. And then kale has a lot of vitamin C. If you're using brown sugar, consider using blackstrap molasses. Blackstrap molasses, especially organic, has is a good source of iron, calcium, magnesium, and selenium. I really like molasses in coffee, and so that's something you can try. If you don't, if you find the molasses isn't sweet enough, you can put a little bit of molasses. Try a bunch of cinnamon. See if the cinnamon makes it taste sweeter. And then you can, if you want to have a drop of maple syrup or some other kind of healthy sweetener, you can do that. Be careful about over-the-counter pain relievers because they can make symptoms worse. So acetaminophen is safe to take because it's not an anti-inflammatory. It doesn't thin your blood. But NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, are blood thinners. So ibuprofen, naproxen, and aspirin can all thin your blood, and they're going to tend to make your bleeding worse. Hormonal birth control can help reduce bleeding and cramping. So sometimes I'm not thrilled with the idea of using birth control for menstrual issues. However, if that's what you got, it definitely works. It definitely works. Whether you are taking oral contraceptives, chemical contraceptive pills, whether it's estrogen, you know, has synthetic estrogen, synthetic progestin, and also progestin dominant pills, and also IUDs can help with bleeding. IUDs, when you get an IUD, you don't want to get the one with copper in it. You have to get the one that has a synthetic progestin in it. And there's a couple of different synthetic progestins that go into IUDs, and it's usually either levonorgestrel or etonorgestrel. And the IUDs are synthetic progestins, so they attach to progesterone receptors, and they make it so that you don't build up, the way they work is they make it so you don't build up as much of a uterine lining. So that, and you may or may not get your period when you have the IUD on board. And if you get it, it's going to tend to be a lot lighter. And when you take chemical contraception, your period tends to be a lot lighter. So that's why they're given. And they can, depending on the brand, the IUD can be in place for 3 to 8 years because the drug releases over time. As I said, combination pills with synthetic estrogen with progestin can also be helpful. And you take them for a month, for 3 weeks, and then you have a week off and you have some withdrawal bleeding. Then also sometimes you're given chemical contraception to take ongoing with no break, and that way you're not going to bleed at all. And sometimes that's how they're used. So progestin tablets can be used as a standalone for heavy bleeding, and they help, as I said, they thin the uterine lining, which can reduce bleeding. And progestin tablets aren't the same thing as progestin-only contraceptives. You can't use them to prevent pregnancy. So it probably depends on the dose. The progestin-only pill probably the dose is lower when you get progestin that's not for contraception. That would be my guess. So progestin tablets as a standalone treatment, you can use them with birth control as well. And then your practitioner is going to consider your overall health when offering these things. And the dose or frequency might depend on whether you use other hormonal therapies, like if you're using hormonal birth control, and also if you're doing gender-affirming hormone therapy, if you're non-binary or trans or genderqueer, whatever your situation is. So people also use GnRH therapies, gonadotropin-releasing hormone therapies, and when you take enough gonadotropin-releasing hormone, it will suppress your menstrual cycle. And so that's given sometimes, and they reduce estrogen levels, which prevents the uterine lining from thickening and shedding. So decreased estrogen may also alleviate endometriosis-related pelvic pain and shrink uterine fibroids. But you are knocking out your estrogen function, and there are side effects for that. You can get hot flashes and things like that. And you can get osteoporosis, all the things that you get when you're peri and postmenopausal, you can get if you take a GnRH agonist. They come in pills and tablets, and they usually prescribe both therapies with hormone therapy to reduce the side effects and complications. So if you don't want to take hormones, there are antifibrinolytics. So antifibrinolytics is like tranexamic acid, and they are used to reduce heavy periods. And so what they do is they block fibrinolysis. So fibrinolysis is when you have products that break down clots, and then you are given a drug that blocks the fibrinolytic compound. They block the enzymes that break down clots. And so that you don't have as much, so you have more clotting and less breakdown. And so some of the fibrinolytics, as I said, are tranexamic acid, and there's also aminocaproic acid, and there's nafamostate mesylate, which is IV, and there's aprotinin, which also is IV. I hadn't heard of those. So then there are non-surgical procedures and surgical procedures for heavy periods. Sometimes there's minimally invasive therapies, and there's something called HIFU, high intensity focused ultrasound, which is a minimally invasive procedure. It can help with bleeding caused by uterine fibroids and uses targeted sound waves to modify or destroy the designated area of tissue with heat. Then there's uterine artery embolization. So that's a minimally invasive procedure. It can treat bleeding caused by uterine fibroids. So if you have uterine fibroids that are falling apart, if you have uterine fibroids, they tend to fall apart as you approach menopause, as your estrogen levels go down. And they tend to fall apart and you have more bleeding. So uterine artery embolization, they inject small particles into the blood vessels leading to the uterus, which cuts off the blood supply to the fibroids so that the fibroids shrink. So because it's an injection, it's not really a surgical procedure. Then there's myomectomy, which is minimally invasive. It removes uterine fibroids but leaves your uterus intact. The approach depends on the fibroid size, number, and location. And a medical professional can do it by making several small incisions in the abdomen. It can be laparoscopic or robotic, or they can make one large abdominal incision, which is a laparotomy, or enter the uterus through the cervix and vagina, which is hysteroscopic. So it depends on what your needs are, what the size of your fibroids are, which procedure. And you want to hope that you're going to get the least invasive procedure. Then there's endometrial ablation. So that's a minimally invasive procedure, and it destroys the uterine lining. So it depends on the size and condition of the uterus. So the uterus is entered through the cervix and vagina using extreme cold or heated fluids, microwave energy, or high energy radio frequencies, and it destroys the endometrium. And when you, it's very unlikely that you'll be able to get pregnant after that, but it's not impossible. And it's a way that you, again, it's a way that you get to keep your uterus, but you probably won't get periods anymore. And you're just not going to have active blood vessels in the uterus anymore. You can also have an endometrial resection. So it's used to remove the uterine lining. You get to keep your uterus, but they actually remove the uterine lining, and you enter the uterus through the cervix and vagina using electrically heated wire, and they scrape out the endometrium. And again, you're very unlikely to get pregnant, but it can happen. And then hysterectomy. If you get hysterectomy, you get your uterus removed. Hopefully you're able to keep your ovaries if that happens, so you can continue to have hormonal cycles. And you can usually get, they can do it by laparoscopy or robotically, and they can also do a laparotomy where they give you a transverse incision at the bottom of your pelvis. So those are the chemical ways that menorrhagia is treated, and there's also a bunch of things that we do to help with menorrhagia naturopathically. So if you don't want to have a surgical procedure or a minimally invasive procedure, there's a lot of things that naturopathic physicians can help you with. And I'll get started on that, but I'm probably going to have to finish that next week. So 18 million women ages 30 to 55 perceive their menstrual bleeding to be excessive. So that's 18 million women. Now, when it's the World Health Organization talking, I'm not sure if that's in the United States or if that's generally in the world. 10% of the women experience blood loss severe enough to be clinically defined as menorrhagia, which is prolonged or excessive menstrual bleeding that occurs at regular times each month, with a blood loss greater than 80 milliliters, which is 2 to 3 ounces or about a quarter cup. So a quarter cup is normal for menstrual bleeding. A quarter cup or less is normal for menstrual bleeding. And if you have menstrual bleeding that's greater than a quarter of a cup, it's considered to be menorrhagia. That doesn't seem like a lot, that your whole period is less than a quarter of a cup of blood. That's interesting. So there's a lot of causes of excessive menstruation, like uterine fibroids, polyps, endometriosis, endocrine imbalances, which is hormonal imbalances, trauma, infections, other disorders, even cancer. So dysfunctional uterine bleeding is defined as excessive uterine bleeding that occurs in the absence of an underlying medical condition or structural abnormality. The term DUB can only be used when the other causes of excessive menstruation have been ruled out, and it can occur with or without ovulation. And it can occur at any age, but most commonly it happens in adolescents and perimenopausal women. So at either end of your menstrual life cycle, when the hormones are not as even as they are in the middle of your reproductive years. About 20% of DUB cases are adolescents after their first menstrual cycle, and they're because of an immature endocrine system, most notably an immature hypothalamus, and perimenopausal women also account for 50% of DUB patients because of decreasing ovarian function, and the remaining 30% fall into women 20 to 40 and are typically because of polycystic ovarian syndrome, emotional stress, athletic training, and elevated prolactin levels or anorexia when you're not eating enough food. There's four subcategories of DUB: menorrhagia, metrorrhagia, menometrorrhagia, and intermenstrual bleeding. For the purposes of the post, we're gonna just talk about menorrhagia. So menorrhagia is when you bleed a lot. Metrorrhagia is where you bleed in between your periods. Menometrorrhagia is where you bleed a lot in between your periods. And intermenstrual bleeding is, I'm not sure how that's different from metrorrhagia, because intermenstrual bleeding would be that you're bleeding in between periods. So here's the thing. I think I'm going to have to talk to you about natural ways to help your excess menses at our next in our next show. So I'm gonna let you go now and wish you a very happy Halloween, a meaningful Day of the Dead, and that you feel blessed by those who have come before you and have made it so that your life can be what it is. You have been listening to Radio Naturopath, the talk show about health and natural medicine. I am Fran Storch-ND, naturopathic physician. You can email me with questions and comments at radionaturopath@gmail.com. If you'd like to listen to the show at another time, you can check out our podcast at whus.org, iTunes, Spotify, Patreon, Buzzsprout, and YouTube. You may also watch the recorded Facebook Live episode at Fran Storch-ND. The views expressed in this program do not reflect the views of the staff, management, or licensee of this station. The information presented on the show should not be construed as medical advice or direction. If you're having a medical condition, please consult with your physician. Thank you for listening to Radio Naturopath, your show where you can learn about the best of science and nature. We'll be back with more Radio Naturopath next week at 91.7 FM, WHUS Stores, and WHUS.org.